Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
If you want to know more about where my guest on this week's show is in her life right now, look no further than the work of the great Nancy Myers.
When I want to practice self-care, all right, when I want to get away from it all, I like to imagine I'm a protagonist in a Nancy Myers movie. Okay? That is, it's about when I'm trying to feel good. If you've never seen a Nancy Myers joint, like Something's Gotta Give, It's Complicated, The Holiday, whenever Diane Keaton is feeling frisky, okay? If you've never seen a Nancy Myers joint, I will break it down for you very simply, okay? First, imagine I'm a white woman. I'm in my 50s, I'm in my 60s, I'm living in the hot flash, okay? I'm in a moment in time. I'm in a moment in time. My name is Margot with a T. And I'm wearing taupe, I'm wearing cream, I'm wearing beige. Yeah. Eggshell, it crew. And whatever I'm wearing is loose, but also fitted. You know? That's my vibe. And at some point in the movie, I will be sitting with my best friend drinking a California white wine. And I'll say, his new wife is how old? And that's every Nancy Myers movie in a nutshell.
This is The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast, and that was comedian Naomi Ekperigin from her new special that is featured in season 3 of The Stand-Ups on Netflix. I have been just a huge fan of Naomi's comedy for a while now, but in this latest half hour, she is really at the top of her game. So I was thrilled that she agreed to come on the podcast to talk about this moment in her career when it really feels like she's about to blow up in a bigger way. In addition to being a fantastic stand-up comic, Naomi has spent the past several years writing for some of my favorite shows, including Broad City, Great News, and the final season of Search Party, which just premiered this past weekend on HBO Max. She is such a delight, and this was such a fun conversation, so let's get to it. Here's me with Naomi Ekperigin. I'm so happy to have you on the podcast. I absolutely loved your new half hour on the stand-ups. It's so, so funny. And it was just, I just loved seeing you in that lineup. It's very, very cool. It's a very cool thing, I feel like, where they put out those 6 specials every, I don't even know if it's every year or every couple of years now, but it's always really good stuff. So were you kind of excited to be part of that?
Absolutely. It was really exciting, I think, especially at this time when it was like, what is even going on in the world? Will I do stand up again?
Yeah.
How long will it take before I'm good again? Like, you know, all those things have been in my head. And it was actually, you know, it was a pretty truncated process. I got the offer came May 25th of this year.
Yeah.
To tape it.
August or last
5th.
Year now. Now we're in 2022.
Correct. Oh, thank God. Still writing 2021 on all my rapid tests.
Yes.
And it is. So basically, yeah. So it was May to then film it in August 5th.
Oh, wow.
So that really just gave me June and July. And that was coming off of, you know, for all of us, 15 months of not performing.
Yeah. How did you deal with that? How did you prepare in that short amount of time?
I ran the streets. At that point I was vaxxed, and that was part of that window of time in the spring.
Yeah, that nice window.
That window when anything was possible. So I just immediately, this moment it happened, I was like, because, you know, I said yes and figured I would, and I was like, I'll figure it out. And I just emailed every comic, especially in LA, because, you know, even in a pre-pandemic world, there aren't as many spots as I would have in New York, just because I, you know, started in New York and I'm from there and know more people. So I just had to email everybody and like sending out DMs, and I'm like, can I do this? Can I do that? You know, and I just got up everywhere. I found a couple spots to work the full 30 minutes. But basically, I mean, honey, I was Blanche. I was depending on the kindness of strangers. Okay. Yeah. And also indifference, like Nicole Byer, you know, who I know previous guests of the show. It was, so as I said, end of May. And then in June, Nicole was doing a weekend at the Irvine Improv with Amy Miller. And she just came and she was like, do you want to feature for me? She was like, I'll give you 30 minutes. And so it was that weekend of shows with Nicole that I figured out what the set was.
That helped a lot.
Yes. You know, and then once I knew what the set was, then the second month is just, you know, trying to memorize it. It's not as memorized as I would have liked it to be. It wasn't as tight. Yeah, I like to be able to like do a set in my sleep. Like I should be able to close my eyes and just say all the words with no one around. And then I can do it on TV.
As someone who has never done stand-up, that's something that comes to my mind often when watching specials, especially, you know, hours and how people memorize that much material and, you know, get all the transitions right from one thing to the next. And I mean, that must be a large part of it that I feel like people don't think about as much.
I know. I mean, it really, and especially, you know, you would think since I wrote it, it wouldn't be hard to memorize.
Yeah.
And yet. So it is a process. But especially, yeah, I'm a real stickler about transitions. So I tend to, that for me is almost, once I figure out, okay, this is what I want to do, I'm almost like, okay, now how do we make this feel cohesive and feel like it's a set, you know, especially like when you hit 30, when you hit an hour, how do you feel like you've seen like a performance? Like it's really important to me to feel like you are seeing a show in some capacity.
Well, I think your special definitely feels like that. It's to me watching it, it's so polished. It's so, you know, putting on a show. And I just love, you know, just even watching you, you know, walk the way you walk on stage. And I think the first thing you say is, this feels right. So I wanted to know, what were you feeling in that moment when you did tape it and walk on stage and have that moment of starting?
Yeah. So that was, and so, you know, it was, there were two, we got two shots.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
7 o'clock, 10 o'clock. So that was a 7 o'clock show. And most of my set is from the 7 o'clock show. Cause it was like the audience was perfect. And I was feeling their energy and just, I mean, it's funny because the 7 o'clock was not the one where I really had many friends. If anything, I was nervous because that was the show my mom came to.
Oh yeah.
And 10 o'clock was where I was having like more people like I was cool with. And so the 7 o'clock, I didn't know what was going to happen. And I went up last of the three of us. It was Dusty, Melissa, and then me for that early set. And so when I got up there, you know, I had been concerned. I was like, what if the audience is tired? You know, they've already sat through, at that point, an hour and 10 minutes, probably more. And so when I got up and I just said to myself, the thing I told myself was like, if I'm just be present in my body, if I'm present, it'll all be fine.
Is so that hard for you to be present, do you feel like? Or are you pretty good at that?
It can be really hard, especially in a taping context, because you are, it's like, I want to be present and I want to just like play to this audience, but everything around me is reminding me that this will live forever and be seen by so many more people, I mean, hopefully, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
So I just really had to be like, just be comfortable, just like be in your body. And so when I got that really warm welcome for the crowd, it was like, this feels right. I was like, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to do this today. Y'all are on board. You seem like you're going to be fun. So let's go. That's how it felt.
From all of the comedians that I've talked to over the years, it seems like the Netflix exposure is a really big deal. I mean, talking about even just with these, you know, the stand-up series, you know, thinking about people like Nate Bargatze, Nikki Glaser, I feel like it really helped launch their careers in a big way. And as you said, you know, this is potentially the thing that will be seen by more people than anything else that you've done. So how do you think about that? I mean, in terms of what you want to communicate about yourself and did you feel like it was really introducing yourself, even though you've been doing this for a long time now?
It really was that fine line. I did have to think, okay, on one hand, because that, you know, initially I was like, okay, are these jokes going to play to people who don't live on the coasts, let alone in other countries? And like, are they going to like me? And like, you know, kind of how much do I need to step things out or explain them more for this version of the set than I would if I was just doing, you know, a bar show in New York or LA. And then I just realized you just go down such a friggin' rabbit hole with that thinking. It's like, honey, I don't know how to play to Dubai. We're just gonna have to hope.
Yeah.
And so But I did think, I'm like, you know, because at this point I had done a half hour on Comedy Central, late night with Seth Meyers, two dope queens, that to me, my initial impulse is to just kind of continue it, not to introduce myself. But I thought, how can I tell the story of who I am that is both accurate to where I am now while also inviting new people in? And that was a conscious thought. You know, I only said Jubu one time, but I felt it did have to be said.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. And so that was, yeah, stuff like that, right? Like, I've been saying Jubu for friggin' years, and I'm like, do I say it again? And then I was like, look, if you're brand new, you don't know.
And if you do know, then it's like a fun little, you know, everyone knows what you're talking about.
Exactly.
Y'all, I am so glad, okay? I got myself a Jubu. That's a Jewish boo. I'm doing it. I'm living the dream. I'm going to be a Jewish wife, you know? And I am going to take his last name, okay? And that's not because I'm traditional and I'm like, I want you to know I belong to him. No. I'm taking his last name because when I do, I will be Naomi Beckerman. That is the Jewiest. I'm like loving it. I'm living for the first 10 seconds of meeting someone, you know, and then being like, you're Mrs. Beckerman? And I'm like, shalom. I'm owning it.
Are you a Jubu, Matt Wilson?
Yes, yes, I am. I am a Jubu.
I love it. I can see it. I can see it in your beard, you know?
Yeah, I know. So yeah, you talk about where you are right now. You have jokes about being in your 30s versus being in your 20s, which I love. And I mean, how do you think about that in terms of your career and being in your 30s, where you are right now? Like, how are you navigating that?
You just mean the constant fear that, like, I am aging with every single day and I may not achieve my dreams? Okay, Matt. Yes, that's what I'm dealing with right now.
Exactly. Well, and, you know, in terms of fame and sort of how you, you know, because I think this special is another step in that direction of fame and getting to be a bigger comic. And you know, do you think about that in terms of how famous you want to get, how big you want to get as a comedian and the career that you're sort of aiming for?
Definitely. It's interesting because I will say that the prospect of fame, if fame were to happen, I would be glad that it happened to me later, right? Because I know who I am and I can kind of separate the fact from the fiction. The one thing I wish, of course, is that I was working at this level for longer, earlier, you know? For instance, you know, I hit an age, you know, between being in the relationship, having my three animals, needing my Wellbutrin. It's like, do I want to go on the road for 40 dates in a row? No, Matt. I'm tie-tie.
But if you get that opportunity or that's, you know,
you gotta do
to headline theaters or whatever it is, then that's what you're doing, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, because sometimes I'm like, oh, I wish I had done all that when I was like in my 20s, when I had all the energy in the world and it didn't matter where you slept. But of course, yeah, I would seize the day in a second. But yeah, I hope there's more to come. It's funny, too, because of course, for I think actors in general, women especially, it can always be so... not taboo, but it can be worrisome to say your age, right? Because you're trying to constantly create the illusion that you're younger than you are. And yet for me, I think I've kind of built up this voice as an old lady in a younger body. And so yeah. I just have to go with it.
Yeah, I know you've talked somewhere about how you always felt like you were wanting to be an adult, or you've always wanted to be an adult from when you were a kid, right?
Yeah. Oh God, I love it. I love it. I always wanted that. I mean, I remember one time we were in school, there was like health class, and this woman came in who had been, she was like an alcoholic, but she was clean now. And she was there to talk to us, you know, about the dangers of alcohol. And she goes, and she said something and I was obsessed with her. She was like, they say that these are the best years of your life. They're not. These years fucking suck. The best years of your life are your 30s. And I was like, okay, yes, yeah, I'm into that's Molly.
Do you feel like that influenced your persona as a comedian in terms of what you know, how you wanted to present yourself and as someone older? Were you doing that from when you were even younger? Do you feel like you were presenting yourself as older?
No, not necessarily. But I will say this. I'm not someone who puts a lot of stock in my looks, my physical appearance. I really was like, I'm not a cute girl comedian. So I'm not going to play that game. Like, in whatever that game is, it was just like, I guess I kind of was like, I'm not trying to be physically attractive to the audience, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, but is that a hard thing to not care about?
Well, whenever people are staring at you, you wonder, is there something on my face? You know what I mean? Like, when people are looking at you, it's like, I obviously, like, wear a nice top and, you know what I mean? Like, give a little makeup. But, you know, when I think about, like, Nikki Glaser, as you mentioned, Rachel Feinstein, women who are, you know, really beautiful and know it and carry that with them on stage, you know? And I was just never that. I was just like, I'll put on a sensible pant.
Yeah, I mean, when Nikki was on this podcast, she said something like she would rather be hot than funny, which kind of surprised me, but kind of goes with her persona too.
I mean, absolutely. And also, I think, you know, hot opens way more doors than funny. Like, well, let's be real.
Yeah, I think maybe as we've progressed a little bit in society with comedy, you know, and even with age, like you were talking about, like, I don't think age is a barrier to being a successful comedian this right now, you know?
Well, you know, Leslie Jones is my idol. You know what I mean?
She's a great example. I mean, yeah, but you know, so many people, you think about Wanda Sykes, you know, people who are huge comics, you know, who are older.
Yeah. I definitely hope to be in that upper echelon. I think it's just interesting because, you know, I have gotten messages and DMs and stuff where people are like, do you have any more comedy? You know, like, because I've seen the half hour and I'm like, yeah, babe.
Yeah, there's
Hit
more.
Hit up the Google. There's more where that came from, you know? And so it's really interesting to, you know, when people say, it's like, where did you come from? It's like, honey, I've been sitting here waiting for you.
Yeah, well, let's talk a bit about where you did come from. So you were born and raised in New York, right?
Yes,
now you live in LA. But what, going back to New York, I mean, what was your relationship to comedy growing up, and when did you first start getting into this world?
Yeah, so I definitely am not someone who would call themselves a comedy nerd. I think, like so many comics, you know, who are like, I grew up listening to albums and, you know, watching stuff. That was not me at all. I wanted to be an actor. And that's what I wanted from that time. I was a very small child. And I always say that as a child of the 80s and 90s, there were so many black TV shows back then that I was like, I want to be on that. You know, like I was like, a different world, please. So that's what I wanted. But I did always watch stuff. For instance, shows that were kind of formative to me. It was like Talk Soup. I remember that show. And Aisha Tyler was hosting at one point. And I was like, oh, this is fun. And she's funny. And then I would watch Chris Rock specials with my mom. Like, I feel like his first one came out in the 90s, like maybe 95 or 96.
Yeah, something like that.
And I was a teenager and he was talking about stuff and like I could sit with my mom and watch it and she was like cracking up. And I never really saw her laugh like that. And I was like, oh, this man has a power. And like the way he is doing this, you know, and how that I was like, oh God, this is really cool. And then it wasn't until I got to college. I went to school in Connecticut, and
yeah, you went to Wesleyan, right?
Yes, indeed, Wesleyan University.
I think we're like exactly the same age, and I have a lot of friends who went to Wesleyan at the same time. We don't need to play that game right now, but but yeah, that you started doing some sort of comedy there, right?
Improv. So I started out doing improv. The group is called Gag Reflex. I just got an email. We're for our 30th anniversary show.
Oh my God.
So
wow.
Very robust alumni group. And what we would do though was the, what was it called? Armando maybe. Basically you would get a word, someone would do a monologue and then you do scenes off the monologue. And I love the monologue part.
Yeah.
Like that was your
jam.
That was my jam. And so that was kind of the first thing that got my brain going. And then I think we did like a stand-up show maybe sophomore year and just like little bits and pieces. And then after college, I worked as an actor with the National Theater of the Deaf, which was in Connecticut. And that was for a year. And then after that, I came back to New York. And that's when I was like, okay, I'm going to try some improv. Okay, I'm going to try a little stand-up and, you know, do little bar shows. I think I did stand-up for the first time in 2007. And just sort of like, and it wasn't like I was a big open micer. It was because I was from New York and I had a lot of friends who lived there. People would put me up on bar shows because I would bring an audience. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Like that's what's most important, right?
Exactly. I would just like show up like seven friends and I'd be like, I'm going to do comedy. Come on. You know, back again, when you're young and full of life. and you'll sit through eight other people to watch your friend talk for 7 minutes. Bless.
And so that's kind of, that's where it started for me, you know, bits and pieces. I still never knew. I had no idea how you made it a life, a living, a professional. And I remember talking to various comics being like, what should I do? And it was just like, they were like, what you doing? You just keep doing it. Like, there's no magic to it. I think nowadays, if I were to meet somebody, I might have more specific advice, but I think that's because the game has changed.
Who were some of those people that you were either, you know, coming up with at the time or who gave you advice at that time when you were first starting?
Yeah, Baron Vaughn, who is hysterical, Michelle Buteau, Carolyn Castiglia, who's in New York. Those are, I just like off the top of my head, like those are three people who I would really talk to a lot because I met out there and was like, what is this? How do we do this? What's happening? And certainly as I progressed, I still talk to people like Michelle and Aparna Nancherla, because Aparna and I are close in age, but she's like, I want to think like, let's say if we're in school, she's like 2 years ahead of me, right? Like in terms of the different things she's done. So I can always go to her and be like, okay, I'm about to do this. What was it like when you did it? And she'll, you know, always have an answer.
Yeah. So you, at some point you started getting into the writing world, and what's the story behind the Broad City thing? Cause you ended up writing on that show, but you started not as a writer, or what happened there?
Yeah. So I was a writer's assistant, which is basically, you know, it's part administrative. You take notes in the room. And I was, so at the time, so I had known Alana through the world of stand-up. We were friends. I was like showing her my writing when I was working on a web series. And so when I got laid off from my job, I sent an email out, you know, to everybody where I was like, I don't have a job. I'm out here. Keep me in mind. So then when Broad City...
What was your job? What were you doing before that?
I was an editor at an art magazine. American Artist Magazine, Watercolor Magazine. I was the editor. Watercolor was the quarterly. American Artist was the monthly. And, you know, I'm just out here interviewing fine artists, not knowing a damn thing about art. Bless. And
so you were ready to move on from that?
Absolutely. Well, no, I got laid off. Because the thing is, that was, because here's the thing. I did not grow up as a person where it was like, just go pack a bag and follow your dream. My mom, literally at one point, I didn't have a job. I want to say I was maybe 24 maybe. And I was like, you know, in between something. And my mom legit said to me, I did not work as hard as I did for this to be your life. Well, Matt, you get it together.
Yeah.
You get it together.
Yikes.
So I always had I always had to have a day job, both kind of for my sanity and for my self-esteem. And so an American Artist was a pretty chill job, especially once I got my own office with a door. Who knows what I was doing in there? So it was like,
writing bits.
Hello, writing bits, blogging. Like I used to do all that stuff. So it was an easy job to maintain other stuff.
I started blogging while at a different day job. And that's what led to this somehow.
Well, okay. Did you do this thing? Because what I would do is I would write my blog post in a Word doc. And so I started to like learn the HTML. So I'm up in there like putting the italics in the bold. So that way, if you just walk by, you just saw
you
just a Word
can't
doc.
Can't really tell what's going on. Yeah.
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 And again, I'm already writing.
I'm sure I wasn't even doing that. I'm sure I was just like straight up in the blogger, Tumblr, or whatever it was. So then do you knew Alana and that kind of led to the Broad
and
City
it led
thing?
It led to the interview. And I remember her coming to me and being like, she's like, so we have this writer's assistant position. Like, I don't know if it pays a lot, but I was like, girl, I'll take it. You know I don't have a job. And I didn't realize at the time how lucky I was to first find a writing job, like in the writer's room in New York City, in a narrative room, in a mostly female room, in a small room. Like, you know, those are all the things.
And
that,
in a show that ended up being so iconic too. I mean,
exactly.
That's very fortunate.
I know. I was like, that worked out. And so because they knew me, and I remember we did some show at UCB that first year when I was an assistant and I did stand up and I did a very good set. It was just one of those nights, you know what I mean? When I was killing it. And it was so important for me to do that because as the writer's assistant, they don't know me, right? Because I don't talk really in the room. So it was so important for me.
You're just
me,
like taking notes and stuff. And yeah.
Exactly. And so it was really important for me for them to see that I was good. And I think that I think that definitely impacted them bringing me back in the second season.
And then you were brought back as a writer in the second season?
Yeah, staff writer in second season and third season. And then that was it.
And do you remember sort of like the first thing that you actually contributed that got on the show, or any jokes or bits or scenes or anything that stands out from your time there?
Oh my God. There's something. So like, there is a whole storyline where Alana's babysitting this little boy and Amy Ryan plays his mom, and he's like, yes, a really like, you know, high maintenance little boy. And that was very much drawn from my own experience.
Oh, really?
Babysitting my high school history teacher's son.
That's
who
funny.
We love. We bless his heart. We love him. And I told her too, like, they both know. I was like, this is influenced by Isaac. This is him right here. And that little boy who was just like, he is allergic to soy and he's a little grown up man. And he means that was, yeah.
That's great. How was that? You mentioned that it was, you know, a very female writer's room, and maybe that's true for other ones you've been in too, but was that, how did it compare to all of, you know, I know you've been in a lot of other writer's rooms after that. How did that first experience compare to some of the other ones that you've been in?
Well, I will say, because Broad City was a, you know, here's what was special and different about it that I, you know, didn't realize till after the fact. That was a small room, maybe 7 of us total, or maybe 8 with me. Everybody was friends with each other. You know, they all knew each other. They went back from the UCB days. And you have the stars of the show running the room. So that impacts, you know, if you pitch something, they will literally be like, no, I don't want to do that. And not in a bad way, but it's like you're talking to the star as well as the showrunner. So it was, and so it was also a very open room. Like, we would tell a lot of personal stories. Again, the way I'm telling you, like, the babysitting, I came from some kid that I actually babysat. So we would always use our real experiences for fodder, or like, you know, you might tell a story to kind of get into the pitch. And then when I got into other rooms, like, I remember when I worked on Great News, and that was like NBC sitcom, you know, they were all much more like traditional writers, like LA people. And I got in there and did this whole friggin' story about my mom. And like, literally everyone was like, okay. And I was like, oh, okay, we don't do that here. We don't get into it.
We're doing jokes.
Yes, we're doing jokes. We were doing joke math.
That was a very like 30 Rock inspired, joke show, right?
Yes, yes. But yeah, and that was not my wheelhouse, I discovered. Yeah.
It's a really funny show. But
It was hysterical. Everyone was so funny. I just, you know, that ability to just like crank out joke after joke nonstop, I don't have the stamina.
Yeah. I was very excited to see your name pop up at the end of the new season of Search Party, which just came out. And I actually have already watched the entire season because I had the screeners, and I'm obsessed with that show and really love it. So yeah, you worked on the final season of that show. What was that experience like? Because that's such a unique show as well.
I know. So I worked on 4 as well. So at least when I came into this last one, I knew what was up. But obviously we did this one over Zoom. So it was COVID times. But it did help that I knew a little bit already, because what I think can be tricky about a Zoom room, it's when you don't know people, right? Because you don't have that in-person like lunch chit chat and water cooler talk and all that kind of stuff.
They're just strangers in boxes.
Exactly. But luckily this helped. You know, what's good about Search Party is that Sarah, Violet, and Charles really have an idea of what they want before the room even starts. So they're like, we want to kind of play in this area. And then, so at least we kind of come in there being like, okay, these are the parameters. And without giving it away, you know, season 5 was wild. And it was like, and I remember when they sent us the document, I was like, what? All right, let's figure out how we're going to get here.
We won't spoil it, but there's like a little bit of Nexium kind of stuff in there. There's a little bit of pandemic almost stuff in there. There's a lot, yeah.
Well, we love cults, you know what I mean? Like, that was so fun because what they'll do too, because they're like, okay, like, have you guys seen this or seen this? You know, so we're all kind of like talking about the same kind of stuff. And, you know, I was very into that Heaven's Gate doc that came out last year.
Yes.
And I was like, okay, we need them dressing Heaven's Gate style. Yeah. We need the haircuts. So, like, I had a lot, like, we were really into all that stuff. So that was fun.
I quite enjoyed your cameo, which we could just spoil a little bit with Whitmer Thomas and Joe Pera. The three of you is great.
What a ragtag team the three of us are. Can you imagine? Like, when we were on set, it was very much like, Joe and Whitmer will be having lunch, and I'm going to be over here in a corner.
Really?
And I was like, this makes sense. No. Obviously, they were super nice, but it's like, they're so, you know, they're like on the same wavelength, but it was so fun, and they were so nice to do that. And it actually just worked out because I was in New York preparing for the half hour. So I recorded that. I remember it was like July 30th or July 31st, like whatever one day I was there, and I was able to do that and then go, you know, and then shoot the half hour the next week. But yeah, that was fun.
And Aparna is so funny in that too. Yeah.
Well, we live for her. We live for Aparna Nancherla.
Yeah. Oh, fabulous. Coming up, Naomi talks more about the early days of her comedy career, including the bold public stance she took on Saturday Night Live's lack of black female cast members. Does she ever regret possibly burning that bridge? Find out after the break.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're enjoying this episode and want to hear more, please make sure you are following The Last Laugh wherever you get your podcasts. In addition to Naomi Ekperigin, we have talked to so many of the comedians who've been part of Netflix's The Stand-Up series, including Nikki Glaser, Nate Bargatze, Fortune Feimster, Dion Cole, and more. By subscribing to The Last Laugh, you can listen to those episodes and everything else from our free archive, and you'll be the first to hear new episodes when they drop every Tuesday. And while you're at it, please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Let us know how much you love the show and who you want to hear next. Now, back to Naomi Ekperigin. So this was a recent TV appearance, but I wanted to ask about one of your earliest TV appearances, I believe, was on Totally Biased with W. Kamau Bell, which I quite enjoyed and just went back and rewatched that. And it's definitely, you it was kind of a risky bit that you did then about SNL and the lack of black women on SNL, which was, obviously a hot topic at that time when you were doing it. How did that come about and why did you want to use that platform to speak out on that?
It was so funny because I do remember that happened at a time when like I wasn't working and I didn't know what I was going to do and I was feeling like so lost. And then at the time Guy Branum was working on that show, cause he had come out had a lot of like hilarious San Francisco people and I remember Guy reached out and was like, hey, I thought of you for this bit. Like, would you, do you have thoughts on this topic? And literally I was like, oh, absolutely. And then we just started talking. And then he was like, okay, come in here. Let's like write this down and figure it out.
SNL is a show about pop culture. And who runs the pop culture world? Girls, black girls like Beyonce, Michelle Obama, and Oprah. And Malia Obama is in high school now. You know she's gonna be getting in trouble. Who's gonna play Malia when she starts ghost riding the whip on Air Force One? And if you wanna do a sketch about her and Sasha, you'd need two black women on the stage. At once. I know that probably violates some kind of 30 Rock rule, but if you can put a dick in a box and three Jews on a boat, you can put two black women on SNL.
And I think for me it was, I did have a moment when I thought it, but I was like, I'm not going to be on SNL. Like, that wasn't something that I was like trying to keep the door open for anyway. I don't do impressions or voices or anything.
But there's a lot of stand-ups on that show, don't necessarily do that, but...
Well, that's true, but I also, again, you think I'm trying to work till 3 a.m?
Yeah.
Like, absolutely. Yeah, no,
I mean, I was notable when in that piece you kind of say, because the whole thing was about how Kenan Thompson made this comment about how there were no black women
who were ready.
And you say in the piece, you say, I'm not ready, but then you cut to some people who you think, were, including Amber Ruffin's in there and some other people.
Hello.
But so you didn't feel like it wasn't even something that was sort of on your radar as a possibility, do you think, at the time? Is that why you felt comfortable? Because I would think that a lot of people would not want to burn that bridge potentially.
I know. I don't care. But I will say it's funny because once the one time I went to see SNL, Sasheer was in it, and it was like my birthday. So I was like, we went and we met her backstage, and I saw Kenan in the hallway, and I had this moment where I was like, oh no, what if Kenan recognizes me from what I yelled about him on FX? And then I was like, I don't think Kenan remembers.
Yeah, I mean, I loved that show, but it did not have a ton of viewers, the Kamau show, but it was great. And it reminded me also of that's the same platform that Hari Kondabolu did his whole thing about The Simpsons. So it seemed like that show was willing to take swings at some of the big comedy iconic comedy
institutions.
Yeah, definitely.
It's fun. I mean, I definitely, I did have a moment where it's like, okay, do I want to say this? But it's like, because here's my other thing about stuff like that. If it is funny and I am telling no lies, then I'm okay with it. You see what I'm saying? Like, if I'm just saying for a fact, like, you don't have these people and these are people who are out here, you can't really argue with that.
No,
like,
you
that's
can't.
Not like, that's not a hot take, really. It's not a contrary stance. So that was the other thing. And that's how I feel about a lot of stuff when it comes to saying things that could get you in hot water, so to speak.
Yeah. You don't worry about it as long as it's funny or as long as it's true or.
Yeah, as long as it's funny and accurate, and who am I and who's the butt of the joke, that was one of the things I thought of in putting together the Netflix half hour, right? If this stuff is going to be all over the world, people can see it, for forever, anywhere, I really did try to make sure I was like, is this how I want to say this? And is this the best way to say it? And, I was serious about stuff. Like I ran some material by some friends of mine who are social workers. I was literally like, does anything ping your ear?
Is there an example of something that you either, changed or rethought or.
Well, the joke, okay, there are two little, so there's a joke in the set about our homeless neighbor and how he doesn't think Andy and I are a couple. And then I'm all like, see, if you would listen to your black girlfriend, you wouldn't be homeless. And then I kind of talk about, and so I was like, okay. We're in a time where people are hyper attuned to, I've lost my train of thought, but people are hyper attuned to, punching down and saying inappropriate things, demonizing people, et cetera, et cetera. And so it was really important to me. I was like, I need to make sure I am making it clear that I am not knocking him as a homeless person.
That's not the punchline, or that's not, yeah.
Exactly. That's just who he is, and the fact that he is, and the extent to which it's like, so that even if someone who doesn't know me hears it, I need to make sure that they're still hearing it the way I want them to hear it, right? Because of course, people who know me, you get it, and you hear it in good faith, so to speak. But if you're just catching me, flipping through channels, and it's like, who this bitch who's talking shit about homeless people? You know what I mean? And you're like, so I had to make sure that, or something very tiny, but that I thought of is like when I'm doing this whole thing about white boys and I talk about, how I'm afraid of white boys. And I just said, like, most white men were once white boys. And for instance, just using the word most was something for me where I was like, let's be inclusive of people who may have transitioned in their lives. And that was literally just something that, like, I don't think that was in the first iteration of that joke. Whenever I first said it, I didn't think about it.
Because you could say all white men, a lot of people would say all white men were once white boys.
Yeah, white men were once white boys, like just period. And it was like, let's just put that there. And again, it ain't got to be a whole production. We ain't telegraphing it. There's not a bit about being trans, but just like accounting for an experience or a group of people. That was something like that. Like those are two examples of things where I was like, okay, mind your P's and Q's. And in both of those instances, it doesn't influence the integrity of the joke in any way.
I mean, talking to you about this, you can tell how much you care about it, how much you think about it. It does feel like there are definitely two camps in comedy right now, one that cares about this stuff and one that almost purposefully doesn't or is actively, rejecting the idea of being thoughtful about this stuff. I don't know. How do you think about that and your role in that world, and do you see that divide in your life as a comedian?
I mean, I definitely see the divide, and we know people on both sides of that. And I think for me, because it comes down to this, and I'll be honest about it, I want to be liked by as many people as possible. Matt, I'm needy, okay? Fill in the emptiness, babe. So, and I'm honest about that. So, like, if I'm doing a joke, and again, what am I saying? It's like, I start with the joke, and it's like, okay, is there anything in this that is hurtful inadvertently? You see what I'm saying? Like, it's just like taking that beat. If I'm trying to, like, drag somebody, I'm a drag. But if it's something where it's like, oh, in using this word choice, like, for something so silly. But, you know, I bring my purse on stage a lot, and I decided to do that in the taping. And sometimes, like, I was like, I would have my purse, and I would, you know, put it down, and I'd be like, I'm like, and then especially in LA, because I'd be like, where are my black people at? Like, you know what I mean? Like, just to be like, is it a safe space? And then for some reason, like, when I was going to do it for the Netflix thing, I was like, what if people think, if I put my purse, I'm like, I got to hold my purse. Where are my black people at? Are they going to think that I'm implying that the black people will take my purse? Yeah,
you don't want that.
And it's like, who, again, I wouldn't think that. But why even put it on the mm-hmm. table, mm-hmm. give the internet the fodder, because that's not what it's about.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's how I am. It's like, and again, it's like, can I put in an extra layer of thought and not only, okay, possibly improve the joke. I mean, of course, best case scenario, but also just like, keep the joke as it stands. Does it hurt the joke to add in a qualifier, you know? And if it doesn't hurt the joke, it's like, yeah, I ain't up here trying to start fights with nobody. I don't need you yelling at me on the internet. I'm stressed out enough, Matt.
I mean, yeah, it does occur to me that when you were in the middle of this, you know, getting the Netflix thing, taping it, it was the time when Netflix was a little bit under fire for the Chappelle stuff, which we don't need to get into too much because I feel
you had a lot of Chappelle talk about in your previous episode. And I said, don't he make me talk about Chappelle?
But the Netflix thing, I mean, you know, it's like it's the same company that you guys are working for. And it's, I mean, did you think about that at all? Or did you worry about that at all?
Well, so this was the thing. So initially, like, they had said, oh, the half hours are going to come out in October. And so at the time that was exciting, of course, because it was like, okay, just 2 months after I've recorded it, it'll feel pretty fresh. I'll have something going on at a time when nothing's going on, you know? And then Chappelle's thing came out and there was that focus on that. And then I remember finding, like, I was so excited about being on this platform and now I feel a little less excited. And because when something comes out, that's like, whatever, skip, cut. Then I remember, you know, so a couple of friends pointed out, they were like, it might actually be good if it doesn't come out in October because you'll be overshadowed by all the conversation going on around this one special. And so then I was like, yeah, you're right. Because, yeah, you hate to be lumped in, but at the same time, you're on the same platform as somebody. But it's like, I'm still going to want to reach the biggest audience possible.
It doesn't, it doesn't really matter. It's his special, even though as much attention as it got, it's one of a million things on Netflix. But yeah, I mean, it was interesting to just see how the company dealt with that. I would say maybe not as well as some of us would have liked, but.
Yeah, it's funny. It's interesting. It's like, you know, I will say, you know, when we talk about, when you mentioned sort of like, you know, fame or the growth of a career, I think the one thing I worry about is being able to stay funny as I get in, if I were to evolve in my career to a place where I'm not able to engage in the world naturally. You see what I'm saying? Like when you get to a point where you're so famous, you can't walk down the street, you can't go to the mall, you can't go to the movies, you know, that really does impact your ability to put together a good set because you're not having the same experiences.
Yeah, I think, and you lose your perspective or you lose your, yeah. I think that's probably something a lot of comedians have dealt with is how do you keep doing this when you get so big? I mean, it's kind of an old example, but, you know, Steve Martin famously quit comedy because he was like, got too famous.
I remember. Yep. He was like, I cannot continue this. And I don't know what you want from me.
Even Chappelle ending Chappelle's show was kind of because of that too. Right. Cause it was like, people are taking my stuff the wrong way. Now we've got to a different place on that, but
that's the journey. That's the journey of a man, you know?
So, yeah, I mean, Search Party's out now. This special is out now. What's next for you? What are you wanting to do? What are you dreaming of?
I am. So we just started writing season 3 of Mythic Quest, which is on Apple TV. And I'll be on that some more. So that I'm excited for that. And I'm just, trying to write some projects, ideally for myself, working on some stuff. And we just write. You just have to see. It's interesting when you do these things, like trying to find that balance between, like caring about it, being invested, putting in the work, but also being completely divorced from the outcome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so
that's hard. I couldn't do that.
Exactly. I'm like, I'm riding the line where I'm like, okay, I have these ideas. And the thing is, I have to like focus on the idea, because the moment I jump ahead to like, they're not even going to make it, or what if they don't like it? I cannot get it done, you know? And so I have to like literally just be like, okay, what's the part that's exciting? Just think about that. Don't think about anything else. Just start typing. Don't start editorializing. And then I can get into it.
Yeah, that's hard. So what I want to do now is our segment called The First Laugh, where we're going to talk about some firsts from your life and career. And you can tell some quick stories, hopefully. So do you remember, going all the way back, the first piece of comedy that made you laugh really hard as a kid? Do you remember something that you saw very early on that you really connected to?
Oh, Lord. I don't know. I loved all TV. I was addicted. I remember thinking Martin was the funniest thing I had ever seen. I remember thinking Martin was hysterical, because that man was wild. And I don't even mean Shanae. I mean when actual Martin was in his house, like a whirling dervish of a human. And I remember he made a joke about how he didn't want to go to Gina's work party, because every time he went to a work party, he would be stuck in the corner talking to some white guy named Bob, who would go, "I just saw Roots, Martin. I didn't know. And I That's remember great. Thinking that was the funniest thing ever.
Do you remember the first time that you knew you were funny?
Ooh, good question. It would have been in 8th grade. I don't know specifically what it was, but I had started private school in 6th grade, and it was like me and a bunch of rich white kids, and I was like really shy at first. And then by 8th grade, I started to I had a little personality. I wasn't so scared. And I used to just like tell jokes and stuff in class, and like to the point where, teachers were like, "Could you shut up?" And I was like, "No, this is my time." And I remember just thinking like, oh, they like me when I'm being funny.
Yeah. We kind of touched on this, but what do you remember? I want to hear more about the first time you performed stand-up on stage. So where were you? How did it go? What did it feel like? All of that.
Do we want college? Like the first time in college? Or you mean like real stand-up, like in a club? And,
well, I don't know. What do you consider the first time for real?
I would say the college show, because it was, I have put together a set. And I'm going to tell us, it wasn't just, and like, it was a show and people paid money for it. It was a fundraiser. So we were really like, we're going to be good. And I remember talking about my then boyfriend at the time, who was in the audience, meeting his parents for the first time in Concord, Massachusetts. And just like talking about, being around the whites in Massachusetts, and like getting laughs and stuff, and people, that kind of response that was like, oh, I might be good at this just talking part.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you remember the first joke that you had that really worked, that really connected with an audience that you could kind of go back to at your shows that was one of your best jokes?
Okay. Best meaning it would work. Yes. And it was about, again, like my early days, about like hooking up with this guy. And I was like, he tried to put his P in my V without a C. And then I was like, trying to give me the herp, the HIV, bring down my property value. And then I'd do a B, and they'd be like, well, he was a white man, so I guess technically he was gentrifying my vagina. Then I would look down and I'd say, they're building a Jamba Juice down there right now.
That's great.
And that was a tried and true. I still got you.
Yeah,
I still got
still
you.
Funny,
like,
yeah.
11 years later.
Yeah, I like that. On the flip side, do you have a worst bomb story that haunts you?
Oh my God, yes. So you mean like a joke or just a show where it was a nightmare?
I guess a show that didn't go well.
Yeah, totes. One time I did a show, and it was like a breast cancer awareness foundation. It was something to raise funds for this organization. And I'm up there and like, it's like older. We're in a hotel ballroom. It was like not the space for comedy. And I did not know how to work with that at the time. You know, I was probably like 3-4 years in. And then I started to do this bit about how I don't like children and how I was, or like when my friends have kids, I start treating them like they have a terminal illness. And I start the bit, and then I realize I am in a room with several breast cancer survivors. And I was like, I don't think this will be funny to them. Like me being like, talking to someone with a kid, being like, you're so brave. I wish I could be strong like you. And I didn't know how to get out of it either, right? Like, yeah. So I'm like, okay, I start. I was like, get to like what might be the first like laugh, and then just like pivot. And like, in the hotel ballroom, here's the thing. You can see the entire audience. You know, that lighting is not for performance. That is a... That
you can see their faces.
Yeah, it was hard. It was hard.
Did you get out of it or did it just kind of end poorly?
Yeah, I pivoted to something and then just like got off stage. Like, you know, if it was 12 to 15, I was off in 12, you know?
Yeah. You also mentioned this, but your late night stand-up debut, I always love hearing about these, you know, the first time on late night TV was, I believe, on Seth Meyers, right?
Yes, yes.
What do you remember about that experience and how it went and what that meant for you?
Yeah, so that was another one where, for instance, so I just recorded the Comedy Central half hour in June of 2016, and that was September 2016. So it was literally, I was like, well, what are my 5 good minutes? I don't know if I have 5 good minutes left. I've just given them all to Comedy Central. So it was like there was a bit where I was like, it was a joke that I probably just started doing a week or so before. And I put it in the set about a food journal and about how I would look at the food journal. Like the doctor wanted me to keep a food journal for 2 weeks so that I would get like a day and a half into the journal. And I would just be like, I see what the problem is here, you know? And it was just like, I think that works. I was so nervous. I have never been more. I find short sets to be so much more stressful.
Yeah. Well, it goes by so fast, right?
Yeah. And you got to like, how do I get them on board, introduce myself and be hysterical?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I loved the moment where you kind of called out Seth and got him to react.
I thought about it. I like wanted, because I had, when I was doing it, I was like, oh, I want to do that. And I was like, but I don't know. I was like, can I? Am I allowed? Whatever. And I just said, do it. I said, shoot your fucking shot.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You out here. They'll cut it or make you do it over if they hate it. So I feel like it's like Donald Trump done let the racists out. You know what I'm saying? He gonna let them out their hidey holes. Like little bigoted meerkats, you know? I'm serious. It's happening now. I'm on edge. You know what I'm saying? If you are lighter than a paper bag, I am checking you. Okay? Yes. You too, Seth Meyers. Okay? Yes. Honey, just because you got dimples don't mean you ain't on a list, you know? I'm serious, like everyone's a suspect, you know? And especially I find myself most on edge when I'm in Brooklyn because there's this breed of hipster, okay? This hipster dude. You know this guy, okay? He's got the sleeve tattoos, the trucker cap, the beard to hide his identity, you know? And you know, if I'm walking down a street by myself late at night, I'm looking at him with side eye like, are you a white supremacist or do you brine your own pickles? You know? And you won't know till it's too late. Thank you, guys. I'm Naomi Carrigan.
Do you remember the first time meeting a comedy hero, a story about the first time that you met someone who you really looked up to in the comedy world that sticks out in your memory?
I met Aisha Tyler at a Comic-Con like 4 years ago. And so she was hosting the panel and I was one of the comedians on the panel, right? So I'm like, I have got to be the funniest I have ever been so that Aisha Tyler will see me as a colleague. I was dying because, again, she was one of the first comics I knew of from, you know, her Talk Soup days. And, like, I had her book. I remember seeing her, like, I have an autographed copy of her first book, okay? That's how far back my love for her goes. And so, and I remember, like, you know, we just said hi before. I didn't want to come in hot. I had to show myself as a performer. Then afterwards, and she was like, you were so funny. And then I was like,
Aisha, I am deceased. I'm going to wet my pants. I am upset. Like, I, and then I just really kind of laid out. It on thick.
Yeah. Uh-huh. That's great. Do you have a favorite Nancy Meyers movie?
Yes. And I think it would be, does she do Because I Said So? Let's do a quick hunt because that might be one of my favorites. Let's see if it's her. But did she write it? I need to know if she wrote it. Because that's, no, she didn't write that one. So then it would have to be, It's Complicated.
That's my answer,
that's
too.
That's just like a jam. Is it real? It's so good. And just Meryl Alec at the top of his game. That was really like, oh, God, taupe screams beige, you know? Yeah,
fantastic. Finally, I like to ask comedians or give comedians a chance to shout out other comedians who are really making them laugh right now or other comedy or just anything that, that is really making you laugh. So what's the last piece of comedy or comedian or something that, that really got you, that really, really made you laugh?
Joe Firestone's new special on Peacock. Good timing. Ooh, I loved it. And Joe is somebody who could just crack me up.
Yeah.
Like literally
so
read the phone book. And she is so funny. Those people, there's a woman in there, an elderly woman whose name is Bibby Elvers.
Yes. Yes.
And just the name Bibby Elvers kills me. Kills me. And so I highly recommend.
Well, that's a great example of being able to do comedy for your as long as you can. Yeah.
Oh my God. I hope to be a Bibby Elvers. Yeah. I hope to be 83 getting on a stage.
I can see it. I think you're going to do it.
Thank you so much, Matt.
Thank you so much for doing this. This was really, really fun. And I've been such a big fan of yours for a long time and I'm glad we got to do this and I'm excited to see you get all these great opportunities. It's really fantastic.
Thank you, friend. So good to be here. You're the best.
Thank you.
Love your beard.
Thank you.
And hopefully I'll see you in the real world.
Yes. Fantastic. All right. Okay. Thank you so much to Naomi Ekperigin for joining me on today's show. Her new half-hour special is streaming now on Netflix as part of the stand-up series. And you can check out her podcast, Couples Therapy, wherever you're listening to this podcast. If you want to support The Last Laugh, please help us out by leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. We want as many people to hear this show as possible, and you can help by spreading the word and sharing it with your friends. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram, where you can see photos and videos from all of our episodes and see who is coming up next week on the show. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Jesse Cannon. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.